Welcome to this session of the Futures Forum. This year, all our sessions are asking what sort of future are we creating for Australians in 2040? Our theme today is the economy, and we could hardly have anyone better placed to stimulate our thinking on what the economy will look like in 2040. John Quiggin is an Australian Laureate Fellow in Economics at the University of Queensland. He's also a Fellow of the Econometric Society, the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia, and, according to his resume, just too many to mention other learned societies and institutions. John's produced over 1,500 publications, including 6 books, and over 200 refereed journal articles in fields including decision theory, environmental economics, production economics, and a theory of economic growth. He's also written on policy topics including climate change, microeconomic reform, privatisation, employment policy, and the management of the Murray-Darling River system. Many of you will probably have heard John on the media, as he's both a prominent commentator as a research economist and as a commentator generally on Australian economic policy. His latest book, Zombie Economics: How Dead Ideas Still Walk Among Us, was released in 2010 by Princeton University Press, and has been translated into 8 languages, including, he's just told me, into Russian for the first time. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Charles. So I thought I'd start with the long view of how economies have developed, including Australia's over the Australian European economy over hundreds of years, but going on considerably longer than that. So for most of human history being the period since we started writing things down, we have a fairly simple economic structure. The great majority of people live by producing food for themselves. Some of that was taken as tribute by some kind of lord or other politician. A small amount was traded, typically locally, for items like the products of blacksmiths and so forth. But most people simply produced agricultural items. The surplus, usually modest, supported cities and towns where a small, largely luxury-oriented manufacturing sector and service sector prevailed. So we had an economy which was based on agriculture and land, where wealth in particular was based on land. We'd mentioned Piketty, a hit book, of a year or two ago, looking back at the economy of the 19th century, and if we go back, he mentions Jane Austen's books at the beginning of the 19th century. Even though in important respects this economy was already fading away, it was still the dominant mode of economy in Britain, so that for anybody who counted, which meant of course not doing any work, you could be counted by essentially the annual value of rent that your land brought in. Almost certainly your wealth was in land. You had so many hundreds of pounds a year coming in from that land, and that was who you were. And the economic theories up to, but not including those of Adam Smith, those of the physiocrats, for example, were based entirely on a land-based economy. And that's been the lot of human history, the vast majority of the human population for thousands of years, and still until very recently, the majority of the human population, of course, despite the presence of a large developed sector in which agriculture was declining. So over the course of the 20th century, beginning in the 18th century, of course, but reaching its full flower in the 20th century, in developed countries, agriculture went from being the central part of economic activity to being peripheral. By the end of the 20th century, agriculture was something like 2% of total employment, a larger percentage of total output. And what developed, reaching its high point in the middle of the 20th century in the most advanced countries, was an economy, a three-sector economy. And most of us of a certain age will have learned this at school. It's still in the names of government departments. A primary sector, essentially agriculture, mining and forestry. A secondary sector, manufacturing, which was involved with processing, turning the various raw materials produced in the primary sector into marketable goods of various kinds, turning wheat into bread, turning iron ore into all the manufactured products that come out of steel mills, and from steel into motor vehicle factories and so forth, turning timber into furniture and things of this kind. And finally, there was a tertiary sector, which basically the role was to handle the process of taking those final products, delivering them to households, so retail, transport, retail and wholesale trade, and doing all the various administrative jobs that went along with it, the financial sector, organising the capital, and various other people, and sitting somewhere off the side was a sort of government sector or a service sector, typically the realm of government, that did things like health and education that really didn't fit very well into the model at all. And we mentioned GDP, gross domestic product. The national accounts of which gross domestic product was a part are a characteristic feature of that 20th century economy. So in the 19th century, there was no real need for a notion like GDP, because essentially the value of product was the surplus above the needs of the surplus above the food above what was being produced by the produced and consumed by the subsistence activity. Until well into the 19th century, that was that, and the fluctuations of agricultural production were the dominant drivers of prosperity and poverty in the short run. We didn't really need to think about things like booms and recessions. They started to emerge in the 19th century, but really people didn't understand them. So, when people thought, as they repeatedly did, about war, the assumption was what you needed was big stocks of gold to buy stuff. So there was a big, that kind of issue of reserves was the big deal. You come to the 20th century and the first half of the 20th century, and you have both two gigantic wars, or one gigantic war interrupted by
by a small period of peace.
Certainly my view. And you have that period being characterised by a huge depression. The question in both the wartime and the depression context of what can the economy produce becomes crucial. In wartime, what resources can be mobilised? If we say we need 10,000 tanks or 100,000 tanks, can we in fact do that? In the context of the depression, of a depression economy, how far below its potential activity is the economy operating? These are questions which were of crucial importance, essentially incomprehensible in the context of an economy of 150 years, an agricultural economy. Those kinds of questions just didn't arise. And in this context of this three-stage economy, very difficult to answer. That is, if you added up, as somebody was suggesting to me the other day, all of the sales in the economy, you get a number far larger than the actual output of the economy, because you would count, if you looked at a motor car, you'd count the steel when it, you'd count the iron ore when it was dug out of the ground, you'd count the steel when it was produced by the steelworks, you'd count the car when it was delivered to the wholesaler, you'd count again the same car with a retail margin on top, bought by the final consumer. And so the crucial notion in the national accounts here was value added. And this is, of course, also translates into tax policy. The great idea of a GST, a value-added tax, as it's called in most places, is you only tax the added value. And so the VAT is a quintessential mid-20th century reform. And the French, I think, were first with it. They had a cascade-type tax that was levied at every point in the process and needed. Australia, by contrast, tax goods once at the wholesale level, which wasn't as much of a disaster, but missed an increasing share of economic activity. So that's the economic structure that current policymakers grew up with, and that still, to a large extent, informs policy thinking. And I was 2 days ago at another futures event, which was Future Jobs in Queensland, and looking at uh, the the outgoing Queensland government's policy was a so-called four pillars policy based on agriculture, mining, construction and tourism, essentially all picked because of a dependence on resources, all picked with this kind of model of an economy ultimately based on land and natural resources. It was consciously, whereas this was sort of had been unconscious in some sense in the 20th century, consciously chosen in reaction to the previous government's smart state policy, so a deliberate in some sense appeal to nostalgia for an economy which everybody, when they thought about it, understood was already obsolete. And in fact it would be interesting to look at the occupational backgrounds of the members of the parliament. You know, I suspect the numbers associated with any of those four pillars would actually be comparatively small, but it counts for something like 25% of employment. And the most notable pillars, mining and agriculture, despite the mining boom, were declining steadily through this period. Although the expansion of mining came to a very large extent at the expense of agriculture, accelerating a decline in agriculture. So, and going along with this is a view that if the primary, depending on how fundamentalist you are about these things, either the primary or perhaps the primary and secondary sectors in which production takes place and everything else is a necessary evil if it's wholesale and retail trade dealing with goods, an unnecessary and parasitic activity if it's anything else, particularly if it's financed by taxation. So that picture of the economy has entirely ceased to be relevant. It's if you look at the structure of the economy now, you can add all of those bits of the economy together on a very generous allowance, they account for less than half of total employment. So the largest occupation for many years, and I think still, has been school teachers, and school teachers obviously, except in the kind of happy rhetoric where young minds are our greatest resource, are not devoted to resource processing. Obviously they need buildings to work in and they need boards to write on, but there's no sense in which school teachers fit this model of something comes out of the ground, is processed and then transformed. This is a pure service, and these pure services, as I say, account now for more than half of total employment, and that's only going to continue into the future. A crucial point here, which I hadn't realised how far this process had reached, but essentially well into the developing world, is that this is partly a product of development, but partly a process of technological change, which has already meant that manufacturing employment peaked some years ago in China, is already reaching its peak in India, and indeed, this is pointed out. I only read this today, and it's an interesting point. A major problem that it means that these countries, in employment terms, can't recapitulate the kind of route of relatively well-paying jobs in manufacturing with a transition to a highly skilled service sector, because manufacturing is already finished before the transition from agriculture is fully completed. So that's an issue for development, which I haven't considered, but we are talking about Australia, so we'll stick to that. We can see, I think, that the structure of the economy is going to continue to evolve in that direction. So the proportion of people engaged in dealing with stuff that, as one of my co-authors once said, you can drop on your foot, that proportion is going to decline, has been declining inexorably, is going to continue to decline, and it's not that the jobs have gone to China. Well, they went to China to die. The jobs went to China, but they're no longer there. They've moved from China onto other low wage countries, but essentially machines have taken those jobs. The technological progress has made those jobs largely irrelevant. So that's one development which I think is well underway and is simply going to continue. What does that mean for lifetime work? Well, it certainly entails increased time in education. So there's still, another aspect of nostalgia is the good old days when you could leave school at year 10, sit next to Sally learning the trade and then get some kind of job. Mr. Howe was very nostalgic for that. I checked his three kids are a merchant banker, a digital entrepreneur, and high-powered lawyers. So I don't imagine any of them actually took his advice and left school at year 10 to take up a trade. But the point is not to run down trades, but to make the point that learning to do a trade now requires the kind of literacy that starts with a year 12 education and goes on to time in classrooms well beyond year 12. So there's a long period when people are basically going to be sitting in classrooms or possibly sitting in front of computer screen classrooms in the future, but certainly not. It's certainly a long period of learning before you can become a fully productive member of society. And at the other end, of course, especially as work becomes less physically demanding and as people's healthy lifespan increases, likely extension of the working life, and of course that's been driven by policy as well. One abiding flaw of discussions of 2050 is discussion of the proportion of people aged over 65, and that's the question: well, why would we be interested in that? It's not the pension age now. It's not. There's no compulsory retirement. 65 is a no more interesting age than 57 or 69. And indeed, those are commonly still combined with statistics which start at age 15. And so we have a set of statistics. We have a set of statistics being quoted as if we lived in the economy of 1930, when the vast majority of people indeed left school at year 10, worked at more or less the same trade for 50 years and then retired. When we try and talk about issues like the structure of social welfare, of retirement incomes, to suggest that the proportion of the population aged between 15 and 65 is important gets things radically wrong at both ends of the age distribution. So the remaining question is what's going to happen to working hours, and there are two parts of this story. One is the long-running trend towards generally shorter hours and greater leisure that took place through the 20th century, with periodic reversals, a substantial reversal in Australia in the late 90s, but the trend has, I think, largely resumed. The other one, which I want to move on to, and which is a feature of the last 25 years since the rise to ubiquity of computers and the internet, is the breakdown of the home-work distinction. And has always been the high point of the home-work distinction, arguably again, was the middle of the 20th century when you had you had the agricultural sector, which of course, in which that distinction is pretty much non-existent, had ceased to be any important area of employment. When you had a strong gender division, so that what you had was so-called, for example, dormitory suburbs, which is a very odd name because you had half the adult population spending most of their day working in these alleged dormitories. It was the men. The men, of course, were leaving the suburbs to go to the city and work, and coming home. From their perspective, that the dormitory metaphor was appropriate. But so what you had was a very sharp distinction between the home run by women and the workplace filled by men. Rise of female employment broke that down in one direction, but the rise of the internet and related phenomena has broken it down even more in multiple respects. So some of these effects being from the perspective of workers, actually or potentially liberating, some of them being actually or potentially oppressive. So obviously the ease with which people can be contacted at any time is something which can be both a boon and a curse. The fact that virtually everyone now has access to computers, which can be used, on the one hand of course, can be used to do work anywhere, anytime. On the other hand, provide employees with opportunities for goofing off, which previous generations, other than the most privileged of academics, could only have dreamed of. Obviously the amount of time spent on the internet is huge, and But that's sort of one aspect of things. But a further one is that the distinction between productive work and leisure is broken down even further than even further than it has when we in the move to a service economy. So if we look at major corporations like Facebook, essentially, we are employees of Facebook. Everyone is. Or something similar. The actual paid employees of Facebook contribute a tiny proportion of the hours that go into making Facebook what it is, and the average the paid component of it is a tiny proportion of what goes, the payment per person is a startlingly small. So I think Facebook has a revenue in the low billions, user numbers again around a billion, so an average payment of $3, a few dollars a year is what people are paying for Facebook. And of course they're not paying for what whoever it is, Mark Zuckerberg and people in their corporate headquarters are doing. They're paying to read the content supplied by everybody else. The so-called sharing economy has aspects of this, of course. Also, this as I harking back to pre-industrial economy practices, where again, if you go back before the factory system, there was something called putting out, where work would be textile workers would work in their own homes, dealing with materials supplied to them by somebody who essentially they were subcontractors. The term, of course, not there. Subcontractors or free agents working out the materials supplied to them by a senior contractor who's making the goods. These kinds of things are again, as I say, have a great deal of potential in different directions. But so I think by 2040 we're going to see these kinds of the kinds of sharp distinction between home and work, which is already being eroded, eaten away very substantially. How we choose to handle that, I think, is a very a question which remains to be seen. I suppose I'll just wrap up now and open for discussion. I mean, hopefully we'll get some more people arriving, but just obviously from this viewpoint, my general take is that the rise and decline of the mineral sector is an issue of a third order importance to Australia. This I think is reflected in the remarkably limited impact that the end of the mining boom has had on a state like Queensland. It's a bit of a bigger deal in somewhere like Western Australia, but it's partly that, as I say, it's not the direction of economic activity, and partly that in the Australian context it's really what's been called an enclave activity. So although in terms of GDP it's a large number, actually, I love to say the only thing wrong with GDP is its gross, its domestic and a product. And what I mean by that is GDP measures the total volume of economic activity, which is what was important in the Depression and what was important in the wars. It doesn't net out depreciation. So if you have a great big piece of machinery that's wearing out, that fact is ignored. Mm. It doesn't distinguish between foreign and domestic income. And so if Rio Tinto or BHP Billiton, a foreign-owned company, is producing a lot of wealth and sending it overseas, that all goes into GDP. That's the domestic part, and there's a sort of cute distinction between product and income I won't go for. But the result is that, especially since we failed to get much tax revenue out of it, thanks to policy failures, what we see is this huge decline in activity, but it doesn't really affect the average Australian very much, except by the exchange rate, which is very much a double-edged sword. So my view is the extent to which our imagination has been captured by the mining boom is a distraction from the main game, which is and will remain education, skill, technology, progressing. So I'll stop there and we can...